Friday, March 6. My first appointment of today was Maxine Cheshire, this morning at 11, who wanted to do a story on the second floor. She had not been along with a group of newspaper women who had been here to tea when I first moved in. She had been in Maine at that time, and because she is a real authority, a longtime lover of the White House, its furniture, its history, she wanted to come up and have a look at it. The ease and naturalness I normally feel in dealing with Maxine and practically any other newspaper woman was somewhat beclouded by my conversations beforehand with Jim Ketchum, the curator, who said they had had a lot of trouble with Maxine while they were during the refurnishing of the White House. Such things are, so he said, as going to Mr. Scalamandri, who doesn't speak very good English, and representing herself as being working for the White House and wanting to see a sample of the fabric that was to be used in the Blue Room, which had up to that point been kept a secret because it actually was white. And it caused a little bit of a flap, and then going around an attempt to elicit the amount spent on certain furnishings by donors who preferred to keep it quiet. So that I didn't really feel easy around her, but we went from room to room and chatted. I did not take her in the president's room or in my little sitting room office, which at present is mostly a storage room for paintings, suitcases, innumerable papers. In fact, the only loveliness in here at present is the view outside as one looks toward the Washington Monument and frequently sees a ballet of seagulls in front of it. Or perhaps some mornings, that giant magnolia, heavy laden with snow. Or looking out the other window, I see right down onto Lyndon's office. And if I stand up, it is into the lovely rose garden. It was fun to hear Maxine talk, though, because she knew so much more than I do, and quite a bit more than lots of the, quote, historians of the White House do, about the furnishings. For instance, in the family dining room, she pointed out to me that this mantel was one of the few made shortly after the War of 1812, that what I had thought to be the medallion of George Washington on the left-hand side was really a medallion of the naval hero in the Battle of Lake Erie, who said, "We have met the enemy and they are ours." The one on the right-hand side, neither one of us, together with Mr. Ketchum, can identify. He looks like an Italian scholar. Maybe Dante. The rest of the day was work on mail. Plans with Lucy about how she's going to get her clothes for the Apple Blossom Festival down in the Shenandoah. I think I'm going to ask Wendy to take over that project for me. Perhaps to take her to New York, to look around here, to find her about the four necessary outfits that it will require to show off her real beauty and to give her that sense of self-assurance that is somehow necessary if you're going to be a good queen of anything. And then at 4 o'clock came the really important part of the day. It was the second big slug of mental fodder that I have had this week, the first being Helen Gehagen Douglas. Florence Mahoney had called and asked if she could bring over a Dr. and Mrs. Bronson Brenner of Cornell University, who had been to Russia for quite a number of weeks and months on an exchange scholarship studying Russian education, and who had brought back some very wonderful slides. So I invited Mrs. MacGeorge Bundy and Jane Wirtz and Mrs. Bell of AID. I was sorry Mrs. Celebrezzi of HEW couldn't come. She's got some sick children. And Marge McNamara, whom I would like to very much to have had come, was out in, still in California. We met at 4 o'clock in the Oval Room, had tea and sandwiches, and then we lowered the curtains and started looking at the slides. They show a type of Russian school begun in 1956 by Khrushchev At present, there's a long waiting list of each school, and they comprise only a small group of the Russian school-age children, although by 1970, they hope to have a third of them in such schools, and by the year 2000, all of them in. There are two types: the prolonged day school and the actual boarding school. The latter takes a baby when it is 1 year old, or it even may take them at 2 months, except that mothers are permitted to come and continue nursing them until they are 1 year old. And then, from the time they're 1 year old, they belong to the school from then on. Parents can come and do all the visiting they want. As a matter of fact, because both parents work, the visits are likely to be only on weekends and perhaps only every other weekend. So that the child really grows up in the school. Physically, they are beautiful. The buildings, the grounds, the interior of the classroom, and not much, they tell me, in Russian life is beautiful, or colorful, or gay. Therefore, these schools are the top of the top and much sought after by parents for their children. And consider that there are so many working mothers in Russia, so it is understandable the extra desirability. These slides we saw showed a beautiful building, very modern and airy, a man-made lake with a green lawn sloping down to it, and trees planted all along the avenue, incidentally planted by the children themselves. Nearly everything was done by the children. I believe it must be conceded that they had a better material setting, better educational facilities, better clothes and food than Russian children in any other schools. They were organized into groups, and then into larger groups, and there was competition between group and group. In fact, it seemed to me any individualism, whatever, was frowned upon. Dr. Bronsenbrenner said that in the nursery age group, if you saw a teacher running, it would be because she saw some little girl or boy wandering off by himself, and you weren't supposed to do that. You always stay as a member of the group to develop your personality. Two things bothered me about this. Two things seemed to go against human nature. One, the complete and absolutely lack of any God or any spiritual value. Everything was the state, the state. Second, the lack of any family life. Can it be that mankind can get used to that, can like that? If it's necessary for the mothers to work, it looks like they would strive to have the children at home with them just as much as they could, at nights, on weekends. But the mores of this new society seem to be that the father goes wherever his job sends him, the mother goes wherever her job sends her, and the children go to such a school. That is, those that can get in. And the accent is definitely speedily upon more of such of them. The Olympic Games would tend to show us that the Russians are certainly turning out some top athletes. And it appears that the terrific seriousness with which they go after this education, they're going to turn out some well-educated people. But are they robots? And if they are robots, will there be somewhere down the road something like in R.U.R., Rossum's Universal Robots, where two of them rebel? I wonder if we're seeing a weapon forged that's even more powerful than the atomic bomb. At any rate, it was an interesting concept and an interesting thing to see. Florence Mahoney is sort of the conduit for a lot of interesting ideas to be passed out in Washington on all sorts of things, from medical research to the influence of Russian education on what's going to happen to America. Oh yes, I almost forgot two, what may be not so important things that I didn't like about this type of schooling. Dr. Bronsenbrenner said they were very silent and you seldom heard them laugh. And second, that one of the greatest heroes, whose portrait you saw on all the classroom walls, was a little boy. who had turned in his mother and father to the state because they had been keeping back some grain in a time of grain shortage. What happened to his mother and father at the hands of the state, I cannot exactly describe, but the grandfather of this little monster or saint, whichever you might call him, killed the little boy, and he thereupon became a martyr and someone to be revered in a society that puts the state above all else. Suddenly, I got an SOS from Lyndon's office to come rushing out to the Rose Garden and meet the Mexican interparliamentary delegation, which I did post-haste, and there, naturally, the first person in sight was the ubiquitous Justo Sierra and Cristina. I shook hands with everybody and said a few words in very bad Spanish, and then came on back home in time to see Lucy, who is just beginning her tutoring in Spanish, and Senora Lopez Maguire, my old friend. I do believe I'm about to get Lucy's problem solved as far as Spanish is concerned by having this extra tutoring. Rather late in the day, I began to wish I could jar Lyndon loose from his office, so I went over there, determined to be very pleasant if I couldn't get him to come home, and found him talking with Marianne Means. I had a drink with them. We asked her to dinner. We picked up Jerry Whitaker. We stopped off by the pool, found suits for both of them, the most luscious-looking white one for Marianne. Called up Marianne's date and asked him to join us, which he did presently. He's the TWA man who's been stationed abroad for so long. And the five of us had a good swim. Lyndon was astonished that Jerry Whitaker couldn't swim. In his very forthright way, he said, "What's the matter? Couldn't you go in any public pools?" And she, I must say, with very creditable poise, said, "That is right." So I never learned to swim. Presently, we all went upstairs, Lyndon and I and Jerry and Marianne and her date, and had dinner. And Lyndon rushed off, very much against my wishes, to put in an appearance at the Mexican interparliamentary dinner. It's simply that I wish he would spare himself the unnecessary effort and save that effort for top-notch priority things and for, hopefully, a longer life with me and Lucy and Linda. So I had exercises and got to bed at a fairly reasonable hour.